everyone, and welcome to another edition of Criminal Discourse Podcast. I'm Trish.
And I'm Maddie.
We're back with you again with an all-new episode.
Da-da-da-da.
There we go. And this one I am going to be doing this week. But before we get started, I have a little bit of crime news over, over the Sophia Tiscon Duplantier case, the three-parter we just got done with. So the latest article that I've read says that the Garda has reached out to Interpol. I mentioned that before, but this time specifically to track down the man that Marie Farrell says that she recognized in a photo of an associate of Daniel Tuscon Duplantier's as the man that she saw outside of her shop and at the Kelfata Bridge. So they want help in tracking him down. Apparently, he lives in France. So I think they want to talk to him.
Okay.
So that's the latest.
We'll see.
We'll see.
I don't know. It's going to take a lot of convincing to tell me that it's not Ian.
Ian Bailey. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see where this goes. They're reinvestigating and we'll see how it all shakes out. Hopefully, they come to some conclusion or can bring someone to justice. All right. Well, we're going to get started on this new case right away. Now, this case came out because I had actually ended up watching The Vow on HBO. Have you seen it?
I've not seen it. You've told me a lot of times that I need to
watch it. You need to watch it. I don't know if any of our listeners have watched it. It's called The Vow. It's on the NXIVM cult. This episode isn't on the NXIVM cult, but...
Because we would need four parts if we did the NXIVM.
Probably more than that. But The Vow was so good. I believe it. I forget how many episodes it was, but it really goes through the individuals that were involved in NXIVM and how they really brought NXIVM down. And I believe there's going to be a season two that's more so the trials of the members of NXIVM that were taken to court. So I watched The Vow, very interested, very fascinating. And then two of the people from The Vow, Sarah Edmonds and her husband, they started a podcast called A Little Bit Culty. And it's really an interesting podcast. I'm interested in listening to another podcast in addition to ours. It's called A Little Bit Culty. And it really is a fascinating look. They talk somewhat to former members of NXIVM who got out, but they also bring in experts to talk about cults and how one can get involved in a cult. And I just remember listening to this one episode where the individual said, don't ever think you could never be involved with a cult because you can't. So that got me thinking like, oh, what kind of other cults are out there?
What kind of cult would get me to join?
what kind of cult would I join? But I remember the episode you did on Steve Menino. It was called Adjacent, but it was involving a cult. What was that? Was it the lizard people?
There were lizard people involved, but I don't think that was the name of the cult.
No. Some woman ran it.
Yes.
I remember.
I can't remember the name.
But people were to be taken over by lizards.
Yes.
Okay. This has nothing to do with lizards. So our story takes place in Wichita, Kansas, which is located on the Great Plains, and it began as a trading post up on the Chisholm Trail back in the 1860s. It earned the nickname Cowtown, as it was where cowboys would bring their livestock up from Texas to the railroads there. That was Bloody Benders, right?
Well, it was around that area. Yeah, it was definitely the Kansas area.
Okay. So famous celebrities from Wichita include actress Christy Alley, Don Johnson, and Hattie McDaniel, who was the first African-American to win an Oscar for her role in Gone with the Wind. She also happened to be the first African-American to attend the Oscars.
Good job, Hattie.
So we begin in the mid-1990s, first in Texas. Daniel Perez had been living there when he met Trish Gomez, and the two had dated for a while, but ultimately remained friends. And Perez moved on, and in April 1996, he met a woman named Marilyn, along with her son and 14-year-old daughter Michelle. Now, Perez allowed the small family to stay with him for a few weeks as Marilyn was getting ready to move to Amarillo. And it was during that time that Perez had forced Michelle, 14-year-old daughter, to have sex with him on several occasions. The rapes also continued even after her family had moved. I guess they would come back and visit, or he would visit them. Charges would eventually be filed against Perez for the rapes, but the case was dismissed when Perez was found dead in Mexico.
Dun, dun, dun.
However, Perez was not dead in Mexico. Later, Perez would state that he pled guilty to the charges of the rapes of Michelle and was given probation. But on his way to sentencing, he had been abducted by four uniformed men who beat him and left him for dead in Mexico. Now, this is his story years later. He wasn't sure if he was dumped in Texas or Mexico, but he claimed that Trish had found him and had taken him to some people that cared for him until he recovered. Now, once recovered, he decided to move to Corpus Christi, Texas.
So how did Trish find him in Texas and or Mexico?
Oh, yeah, I have no clue.
Okay.
This is his version of events, but clearly he recovered, didn't turn himself in, and he moved to Corpus Christi. Now, Perez didn't stay in Corpus Christi long, and by the summer of 1996, he had moved to North Dakota, and Perez was 46 years old at the time he had moved there. There, he met a 15-year-old girl who only goes by the initials KL. Everything I researched never gave her full name. And she believed that Perez was much younger than his actual age, and soon the pair began a sexual relationship. I don't know what the age of consent in North Dakota is. I'm not sure it's 15. So it was during their relationship that Perez convinced KL that he had magical powers. He claimed that he could make it rain, or he could see someone's past, present, and future, and he could communicate with others on the other side.
Those are some pretty serious powers.
They are. So it was 3 months into KL and Perez's relationship when the honeymoon ended, as law enforcement had apparently come to KL's home and arrested him and then deported him to Mexico. However, Perez was a U.S. citizen and...
I'm not understanding. What? Why did they deport him to Mexico?
Well, he's Hispanic looking, so maybe that's why.
So they were just like, gotta be a Mexican and sit.
I'm not even sure who these four men were. This information came out of the appeal that I read.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's his story of events, like this is kind of what happened, or he had someone pretend to come and arrest him to get him away from KL. But again, he's a U.S. citizen, so it doesn't even make sense that he'd be deported to Mexico.
No.
So the couple would remain in contact by phone, though, over the next year, although KL didn't know where Perez was living, which made me think it was more of a setup kind of thing.
Yeah.
So Perez was actually back in Corpus Christi, Texas, but had assumed a new identity, that of Lou Castro. Castro wasn't single for long, as he had met a woman named Mona Griffith, who happened to live in the same apartment complex as him at the time. The two, along with Mona's 14-year-old daughter, Lindsay, and her son, Cody, moved in together. Now, Trish had also moved in to another apartment complex, and then, soon after, the group moved to Wichita, Kansas for a few months. Now, Cody would stay behind with his father, but while the group was in Wichita, Kansas, KL would soon join them. But she only stayed for a short period of time because she had to return back to North Dakota to finish school, because she's 15.
She's 15, right.
So it was after KL left to go back to North Dakota that this group decided to move to South Dakota. It was in South Dakota that Trish met Brian Hughes, and they soon started dating, and they ultimately would marry. Now, Mona had also met a man named Jim, and the couple soon became engaged. So even though she met Perez or Lou Castro by this time...
We didn't already do this case?
No.
Okay. Sorry. I know this case.
You probably do because Dateline did something on
okay,
it. So if
maybe
you
that's
listen,
why. I was like, I feel like
I think Dateline's done something. And then there was an episode on Oxygen called Deadly Cults. So
okay.
It's all referenced in the resource section of our notes. But those are the two main ones. I think the Dateline episode was named Angel's Landing. So, and we'll get to that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No,
I was just nervous that we were re-recording an episode.
That would be terrible. They'd probably be like, oh, Trish lost it. Okay, so Mona had met a man named Jim, and they became engaged. So while in South Dakota, Castro, that's what he was going by now, Lou Castro, Trish and Mona had went to see an insurance salesman, and Mona had taken out a $750,000 policy on her life, naming Lindsay her beneficiary, her daughter, and Trish was named Lindsay's caregiver. So in case something happened to Mona, then Trish would take care of Lindsay. Tragedy soon struck the newly engaged couple as the plane they had been on with Lindsay had gone missing. Now, Jim apparently had a private pilot's license, so he flew small planes. So Castro and Trish had attempted to cash in on Mona's policy, but the insurance company would not release the money as Mona's body hadn't been discovered. They disappeared. But not to be deterred, Castro and Trish repeatedly visited the insurance company while the search for the downed plane continued. Now, eventually, the wreckage would be found, and death certificates were issued for Mona, Jim, and Lindsay. With those certified, Trish was paid out the $750,000 death benefit. Now, in the summer of 2001, Trish, Brian, and their newborn daughter, Nicole, along with Castro and KL, moved to Lee's Summit, Missouri. They had all moved into a home purchased in KL's name. Sure how old she was at this time, but I'm like, okay. But after 3 months, the small group moved back to Wichita, Kansas, where they lived in some townhomes while looking for permanent housing. Now, upon settling, Trish took out a $1 million life insurance policy on her life, that included an accidental death rider, and her husband Brian was named the beneficiary, with KL being named the co-beneficiary. You're shaking your head.
Don't take out why. Why, Trish?
Oh, we're going to get to that.
Like, it can't be good news.
No. So, in addition to the small group, there was Jennifer Hudson. She was a real estate agent from Missouri who had moved there with her two daughters, Emily, who was age 10 at the time, and Sarah, who was 17. Now, Jennifer had sold Castro and his group property in Missouri when they had stayed there only for that short time in 2001. So while working on the real estate transaction, Jennifer had spent a lot of time with Castro, and they soon developed a friendship, and then that developed into something more. So Jennifer would end up divorcing her husband and again moving her and the girls to Wichita, Kansas in June of 2001. Now, Castro had gotten not only Jennifer, but her daughters and others to believe that he was actually over 100 years old and that his body was often inhabited by one of three angels, Arthur, Daniel, and Amber, who happened to be the angel of death, which I thought was a little sexist. Why is the girl the angel of death? So Trish would tell the others that when he was young, Castro had actually died, and when he came back, he had these powers. I don't know if that was on the trip to Mexico or not, but both Emily and Sarah, who were very young, especially Emily, who was 10 and was very impressionable, believed what the adults were telling them. And these adults, like, they go on to say that Trish really was like a second mother to them. These were nice people. Mm-hmm. They were. They weren't kind of like, you know, I always think kind of cult leaders like Jim Jones or somebody like that, like tyrannical. They weren't really. They were just really fun-loving people, minus Lou Castro. So by the spring of 2002, the small group had purchased three homes side by side in their Sedgwick County, Kansas community, which was, I think, located right outside of Valley Center. The group referred to their collective as Angel's Landing, hence the title of the Dateland episode. So the first house came with 10 acres of land and was purchased by Trish. And then Jennifer soon bought the adjoining 10 acres and built two homes on it. And the third parcel of land was bought and built upon completing what looked like a compound due to how the homes were placed. So also on the properties were a barn-like structures that housed the group's various vehicles and Castro's large model plane collection. Those model planes that you can fly, though. Mm-hmm.
The big ones.
Yes, the huge ones. So Lou Castro seemed to have met all the group's needs, and they, by their own accounts, were living a very extravagant lifestyle with lots of material possessions at their disposal.
Did any of these people work at this time?
Yeah, some did. Like, well, Brian Hughes, he was a mechanic, or he worked construction too. And then there was another member that joined the group who worked construction. I think Jennifer went into real estate still because that's what she did. So yeah, some of the group members did have jobs, except Lou Castro didn't seem to have a job. So it was in the Angel's Landing that Emily had moved into the master bedroom with Perez. Emily was 10 at the time. He had convinced the group that he needed someone, quote unquote, pure to share his bed as he was a, quote unquote, seer and needed a young female virgin to take care of him or he would die.
All the red flags. There's so many red flags.
So this next part, before I get to it, we are going to be talking about issues of child abuse. If that is a trigger or unsettling to you, go ahead and skip ahead a little bit. We don't want to upset you, but it's important to the story in the fact that what he made her do and who he really was, right? Not this person who continued to be very gregarious and charismatic and fun-loving. There was a darker side to him. So in January 2002, Castro had started forcing Emily to give him sex, both orally, vaginally, and anally. He had forced Emily's older sister, actually Sarah, into the same sexual perversions. But I don't think the two sisters talked because he had threatened both of them separately. By 2007, the acts of sexual and violence increased with actually all three girls, including KL. On two occasions, Castro had forced all three girls by gunpoint and threats of violence if they didn't comply with his commands. He threatened to kill Emily and Sarah's father, whom they loved very much, and KL with her own life if she didn't, in his words, step it up. And again, these threats were they did not feel that they could go to the other adults in the group because, you know, they all lived relatively close together.
Yeah. And I mean, we've seen it before, too, especially when you have like multiple siblings. If you don't do this, I'm going to do this to your younger sister and vice versa.
Yes. And again, they believed he was this presence, had all these powers. So the dynamic in Angel's Landing was mostly Lou Castro was the boss, with Trish kind of being the second in command. And according to both Emily and Sarah, Trish was like a second mother to them. They really loved her and she loved them. She, again, very kind, very sweethearted. So in June 2003, Castro and Trish told Emily that it was Trish's time to go and that Trish had failed to cross over during an earlier accident. Castro told Emily, she's like 10, 11 at this time. Castro told Emily that Trish would be found dead by the pool after she fell and hit her head. He asked Emily if she would like to be there when it happened, and she said no. And Castro then told her that he would, quote unquote, bend time so that she would not be there, but would be there as it happened. He went on to tell Emily that after Trish passed, that she would put Nicole, the baby, into the pool and then pull her out and call 911. Emily would tell authorities that Nicole had fallen into the pool and Trish had slipped and drowned while trying to save her daughter. Emily told the couple that she was sad about Trish dying, but Trish, who was there and knew all this, assured her that she would eventually come back in a new, healthier body. So 2 weeks after this conversation, Castro told Emily, today's the day. So only Castro, Trish, Emily, Sarah, and Nicole were at Angel's Landing that day. Everybody else was gone or working. Castro told Emily to take Nicole into the nearby pool house and to not come out. He had sent Sarah up ahead to a local car dealership to wait for him, so she was not at the house at this time. And Emily, from inside the pool house, hears a scream from Trish and then a splash. Castro then came to Emily and told her to wait until he met up with Sarah and then to call 911. So give him like 15, 20 minutes. So Emily waited 20 minutes and completed the plan. Afterwards, after she called 911, she called her sister Sarah at the car dealership crying, telling her that Trish fell in the pool. So when paramedics arrived, they were surprised to see Trish floating in the shallow end of the pool, but believed the story that Emily told, that Trish had rushed into the pool to save her daughter, but had slipped, hitting her head and drowned. And then Emily ran out, save Nicole, the baby, and then tried to get Trish out of the pool, but could only drag her to the shallow end of the pool. Trish was 26 at the time she was pronounced dead, with her cause of death being accidental drowning. There was an autopsy conducted, with the coroner finding that Trish had a blunt force injury to her head, but based upon witness statements, that of Emily, of her slipping and hitting her head, they ruled it accidental. In 2003, Trish's death benefit was paid out to her husband, Brian. Soon after, new, more expensive vehicles showed up in the driveway. Now, prior to Trish's death, the group owned two Corvettes and several SUVs, and over the years, Castro would spend upwards towards $1.5 million on lavish vehicles for the group. And all the vehicles had license plates with like Angel 1, Angel 2, Angel 3, Angel 4. They didn't really divert from the angel theme.
The creativity wasn't really there.
Right. His extreme spending didn't seem to stop with just the small group at Angel's Landing. At one point, Castro would give local police departments $19,000 to go towards a new police vehicle. He also hosted lavish barbecues at Angel's Landing, where the police were always welcome to attend, and some did. The small group continued to live at Angel's Landing after Trish's death, and it was during that same year that Jennifer began dating a man who had joined the group, David Quaring, and he had joined in, I think, 2003, and he had met the group or was introduced to the group through Brian. They had worked construction together. And David, again, a nice guy, and he had lost his wife, and he didn't really like being alone, so he was really happy to move into this little group, this little family. In 2004, the couple began living together, and according to the appeal, they eventually married, but there was no mention of this marriage during the Dateline episode or the Deadly Cults episode that I had seen. So in 2004, Brian, Jennifer, KL, and another woman, Megan Harbert, had taken life insurance policies out on their lives. Castro was always present when these policies were taken out and directed who would be taking out the policies, how much the policies would be for, and who would be named the beneficiaries. Castro was never named the beneficiary or named in any of the policies. Megan and Castro were also dating at the time, and Megan had actually moved into Castro's home. And the two would end up having a child together, Angelica, in December 2004. Now, on March 2, 2006, Brian had left Angel's Landing to visit South Dakota. Castro had told a friend that he didn't think Brian would be returning to the group. Was he clairvoyant? Brian was killed in what would be ruled an accident in South Dakota. His death benefit would be paid out to KL. Now, Brian was a diesel mechanic. that was his trade. And from those that knew him, he was always safety conscious when working under vehicles. So it surprised many that he had been crushed to death under a vehicle when the jack slipped. Years later, Sarah thought that Brian may have taken his own life, mostly due to never getting over Trisha's death and Castro's teachings on death and crossing over. She, in an interview, she states that right after Trish died, of course, Brian's devastated. I don't think he knew about this plan at all. And Castro spent a lot of time with him, more so than he ever did. So she feels that he was talking to him about, you know, his grief and using that grief to get him to kill himself. So in August 2006, Sherry Cox and her 8-year-old daughter, Cece, initials, had begun to visit Angel's Landing. And Castro took an immediate interest in the young girl and had her pose provocatively in her swimsuit as he took pictures. He also had a camera placed in the bathroom in which to watch her change. Yeah, he's a sexual predator. Mm-hmm. I think we can agree on all that. So Ron Goodman, a Wichita narcotics detective, had been investigating Castro and his group since 2003, the year Trish died. And his investigation was because Castro had seemed to draw attention to himself, not only with the parties, but this unexplained wealth. And in this, you know, in the detective's profession, unexplained wealth usually meant drugs. So Goodwin began to do an internet search to find out what he could on Lou Castro. And that is when he came across an obituary for Mona, Jim, and Lindsay that had Lou Castro's name attached to it. I think they said in the article that Lou Castro was her brother. He wasn't her brother. So now Lou Castro has a connection to four deaths. These three he found in the article and Trish. Mm-hmm. So in Goodman's mind, with the group of homes being referred to as Angel's Landing, all the car vanity plates with Angel designation on them, he thought, like, is this a cult? Like, just that's the first thing.
Kind the of flag's popped. Going up.
Well, yeah. Is it drugs or is it a cult or is it a drug cult? You mm-hmm. don't know. So although Detective Goodwin was unable to find any records of Lou Castro, even a birth certificate, he was able to unravel the financial dealings of the group. And he was able to look at bank balances for the majority of the group members. And what he found was that every 2.5 years or so, when the balances would be significantly low, you know, maybe sometimes down to just a few $1,000, then someone would die. The insurance payouts would replenish the accounts. This happened like every 2.5 years. Trish Hughes had actually had a 1.24 life insurance policy paid out to her husband, Brian, because she had that accidental death rider. So when he died, his assets and policies were paid out to KL. So again, she died 2.5 years later. He dies. What Detective Goodwin theorized was that instead of dealing drugs to afford the lifestyle, Castro had talked people into taking out large life insurance policies and indoctrinating them into killing themselves. The problem was they didn't have a crime, just suspicions, right? They couldn't really prove everything. Everything was accidental. That all changed one day when Detective Goodwin happened to come upon Castro driving down the road, and he decided to follow him. And Castro had gone into a restaurant to have a meal with someone. And when he left, the detective asked the restaurant manager, hey, can I have his water glass, his silverware? And the hope was that they could get a fingerprint and finally find out who this guy is, because there's no record of him. But unfortunately, the lab was not able to lift a good print off of anything the detective had collected.
So do they know, like, did he wipe it down or was it just not?
I think just the way the material was, they weren't able to get anything. And I don't think they were extracting DNA because he really didn't have a warrant, I think, for that. I'm not sure, but they were just looking at fingerprints at this time to determine mm-hmm. who he was. In September 2008, Detective Goodwin was notified that Jennifer Hudson had been killed in a car accident. According to reports, eyewitness statements reported that there was no way Jennifer didn't see she was heading straight into an oncoming truck. In Goodwin's mind, he believed that Lou Castro had influenced Jennifer to commit suicide. This was about 2.5 years later, after Brian's death. And sure enough, the bank accounts were running low again. And when Jennifer died, leaving behind a $1 million policy, those coffers were replenished. So Detective Goodwin, still not giving up on finding out who Lou Castro was, decided to try to get his fingerprints again. So he shows up at Angel's Landing with another detective, and this time he has glossy photographs of some made-up suspects. So he comes up with a story like, there's been some suspicious activity in this area. Can you look at these photos? Tell me if you recognize anybody, in the hopes
he'll touch it.
And he'll touch it.
Get a fingerprint.
Get a good print. So what Lou ends up doing is he dumps the photographs on a nearby pool table and then uses his fingernail to move the photos around, like he knew exactly what the detective was trying to do. Well, needless to say, they didn't get a print. So after that, Lou started to get nervous, telling Sarah that, quote, they were trying to get him. unquote. Lou took off to look at houses in Tennessee soon after. Now, by this time, Lou had caused a wedge between both Sarah and her sister, Emily. So KL initially stayed behind with Emily and Nicole so they could finish up the school year, but then the three eventually joined the group in Tennessee in June of 2009. Now, Emily's sister, Sarah, she didn't move with the group. She was living on her own outside of Angel's Landing at that time. I think she was 24, and she talks about being on her own for the first time and how just freeing it was. And she soon began dating a man named Daniel McGrath. Now, as the two's relationship deepens, Sarah shared with Daniel about all the group members' deaths, along with the group expectations that they serve Castro. But more importantly, that the group was supported financially by the life insurance payouts that they had received over the years. That's how they bought these homes. That's how these cars were bought. She would also end up telling Daniel that Lou had raped her from the age of 17 until the age of 24. Now, Daniel, God love him, if you want to ask about somebody who like steps up, he knew immediately, like, yeah, this isn't right. It's not right that this guy gets away with it and is still continuing to get away with it. So he reported all of this to the FBI. And in January 2010, Ron Goodman and John Sullivan of the FBI interviewed Daniel about what he had reported. So John Sullivan, it turns out, had been investigating Castro since 2007. So this was kind of their big break, that this person was
giving them information.
Yes. So through their investigation and Daniel's tip, they found out that Castro had assumed a new identity, this time of Joe Venegas, and he was now residing in Columbia, Tennessee. So with this new name, investigators were able to see that Joe Venegas had opened a new bank account in Tennessee. And when they looked at the bank surveillance tapes, they could see him on film and they knew they had him for committing bank fraud, at least. So in April 21st, 2010, a search warrant was executed for the Venegas Tennessee residents. And there was a sense of urgency since it was getting near the 2.5 year mark.
Is that the statute of limitations or?
No, the 2.5 year mark.
That when somebody was going to, yes.
That was the sense of urgency they had. So from that search, detectives discovered 11 firearms, two wallets that contained identification for Lou Castro and Joe Venegas, along with a social security card and birth certificate for Joe Venegas. And so Castro/Venegas was taken into custody that day. Now, after being formally fingerprinted, finally got their fingerprints, investigators discovered that Lou Castro, Joe Venegas, was in fact Daniel Perez. So in the meantime, Castro Perez Venegas was sentenced to 2 years in jail for aggravated identity theft and social security fraud. So the investigation continues into March 2011 with authorities interviewing on several occasions Sarah and Emily. Now, Sarah would tell investigators about her abuse that she suffered for years by Lou Castro, as would Emily, I believe. She shared that also, but she also shared that when she was 11, what happened involving Trisha's death. So in what she told the investigators about the drowning would eventually put Lou away, Perez away. I don't know which name you want to use. So on September 11th, 2011, I'm going to go back with his original name, Daniel Perez, was charged in Sedgwick County District Court in Kansas with one count of first-degree murder for Trish Hughes' death, 10 counts of rape, 10 counts of aggravated criminal sodomy, 3 counts of aggravated assault, 11 counts of making false information, and 1 count of criminal threat. However, by the time Perez's trial rolled around, charges had been amended to 1 count of first-degree premeditated murder, 1 count of sexual exploitation of a child, 8 counts of rape, 7 counts of aggravated criminal sodomy, 3 counts of aggravated sexual assault, and 8 counts of making false information. So the trial took place in February 2015, and several witnesses from the group testified for the prosecution, including Daniel, KL, Emily, Cody, Michelle, Marilyn, David, Megan, Sarah, Cece, and Cece's mother. So the witnesses testified to the group's transient movements over a 15-year period that included several states, Texas, South Dakota, Missouri, Kansas, Tennessee, and Mexico. They also testified to ongoing sexual violence by Perez and the deaths of 6 people connected with the group: Mona, Lindsay, Jim, Trish, Jennifer, and Brian. The various group members would tell the jury about the control that Daniel Perez had over the group. Emily testified as to what happened on the day Trish had drowned. Trish's death is the only one Perez stood trial for, however, because the others were, you know, by suicide or accidental.
Yeah, and it's unless they had a recording of him convincing somebody to commit suicide, there's no way that they can prove anything.
Correct. So insurance agents and car salespeople also testified as to his spending habits. Mm-hmm. So Sarah would later state on the show Deadly Cults that Lou Castro told her that he had to, quote unquote, fix her so that she would be able to get married and have babies someday. The younger daughter, he convinced that he needed her to keep him seeing powers. He convinced Sarah that he needed to somehow fix her. The fix her part of his plan was to have sex with her on an ongoing basis. He would also tell her that if she told anyone, she'd kill her dad. And in Sarah's mind, she would do anything to protect her father, so she kept quiet about the abuse. She would also disclose that one day Lou had sat her and her sister Emily down and told them that it was time for their mother to die. Sarah had gone to her mom and told her what Lou had said, and Jennifer told her, don't worry about it. You don't have to worry. It's going to be fine. But then Jennifer would die in a car accident when she ran into a fully loaded hauling truck and was killed instantly. So in Sarah's mind, she knows that what he did to Brian, he did to her mom. Perez testified actually in his own defense, along with three other witnesses, and he claimed he was not home the day Trish Hughes drowned and he had no part in her death. On the stand, he denied having any sort of magical powers and contended that sex was always consensual. So he seemed to always place blame on others, taking none of it on himself. And as for his crimes in Texas, he said, well, I pleaded guilty to them, but I never served time because, you know, the beating I received caused me to have amnesia for years.
Yeah, and change my identity and move far away.
Correct. He also claimed upon cross-examination by District Attorney Mark Bennett that he had no idea where the money had come from to pay for his lifestyle and that it all really belonged to the other group members. And he claimed that the women of the group held the money and they had all the say in the financial matters. Needless to say, the jury did not believe him, and he was convicted on all counts and sentenced to 2 life terms with consecutive sentences for 80 years. He is currently being housed at the Lansing Correctional Facility in Kansas. And that is the story of
Daniel Perez, Angel's Landing?
Daniel Perez, Lou Castro, Joe Venegas / Angel's Landing. Correct. But what really got me through all this, I'll kind of go back to a little bit culty podcast and listening to the experts talk about how people get indoctrinated in cults. Because again, all of these people were good people. They were nice people. They didn't seem to have a mean bone in their body. They're just regular people.
Mm-hmm.
That got caught up in something bigger than themselves. They do say they all had some vulnerabilities somewhere. I think in Emily and Sarah's mom, they always talked about that she was always fascinated with angels. That was her big thing, angels. And I don't know if that was his hook there. And then with Brian, again, he didn't want to be alone. His wife had died. And so this group kind of took him in. And again, everyone's so nice. But yet, this man was able to convince them to take out these massive life insurance policies. If he would have said, it's time for you to take a life insurance policy, I'd be like, no, it's time for me to go. Yeah. So, because it doesn't bode well when you take a life insurance policy.
But who knows? I mean, that's the thing when you see these cults, they pick people also where they can see that vulnerability and play into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, like, you don't know what messages he was giving them, because apparently he was convincing them that, you know, Trish would say that I'm going to come back in a better body, like a more improved person, like these types of things. Who knows if they've really thought.
Yeah. Death is just temporary.
Right.
And Daniel can bring us back. Yeah. It's a fascinating case. Like I said, you can, if you get oxygen, look up the Deadly Cults episode. And of course, I know Dateline did the episode Angel's Landing. I think you can listen to it on their podcast or if you can find it.
I think it's interesting, too, that he seemed to like focus on them individually. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the group thing. Like,
yeah.
Not like the group mass death, but like focusing on them one at a time.
Yeah. And it didn't sound, from everything I've read and anything I watched, it didn't seem like you think of cult leaders that have group sessions where they sit them all down and they talk to them ad nauseum and kind of the indoctrination that way.
Yeah.
That didn't seem to happen in this case. That wasn't really what was going on.
Well, and maybe that's part of the reason why he was able to convince them. Because like Trish never talked to Brian, obviously, about what was going on.
Yeah, I'm going to die and I'll come back healthy.
Yeah.
Just wait.
Because by keeping it one at a time, then you're not raising the suspicions of the rest of the group.
Mm-hmm. And the only people you're really telling is like an 11-year-old girl. You've been raping her.
Mm-hmm.
She has that trauma. She thinks you're the angel of death or 2 other angels.
Yeah.
And she can't really turn to her mom because her mom believes you too.
Yeah.
So it is. It's a fascinating case.
So if you enjoyed what you listened to today, you can leave us a review on whatever platform you're using to listen today. You can also reach out to us through our website, criminaldiscoursepodcast.com. We have an Insta, Criminal Dose Pod. And yeah, as we say, I'll let Trish say.
Yes, if you see something, say something. You might have that missing piece of the puzzle it takes to solve a crime. Like Sarah's boyfriend, mm-hmm. who heard this story and immediately felt like, oh no, people need to know about this. And the detectives that never gave up.
Yeah.
You know, they worked on this for a lot of years. So as always, we want you to be safe, but let's remember, we also need to be kind to one another. So until next time, guys.
Bye.